Oscars.
Welcome to No Prize from God, episode 15. No Prize from God features conversations with creative people about belief, unbelief, and everything between. My guest this episode is Eitan, co-founder and frontman for legendary black metal pioneers Emperor and accomplished solo artist. Black metal grew from sensationalized extreme music scene, splashed across newspaper pages and television reports, with its theatrical pageantry and grim connection to church burnings and even murder, both within and outside its own ranks, to become arguably Norway's biggest cultural export. A mixture of lo-fi punk aggression, fierce tempos, savagely screeching vocals, and overall ambiance, black metal music is virtually inseparable from its spiritual purpose. Within the spectrum of the creative art to have sprung from the scene, there are calls for a return to Europe's pre-Christian religious traditions, often paired with an antagonistic aggression determined to strike a blow against Christianity itself. For some, it was rebellion for its own sake, regardless of the window dressing. For others, it's as much a philosophy and lifestyle as anything else. While there are of course important black metal bands elsewhere in the world, and the music can trace its roots to everything from new wave of British heavy metal to American thrash, no other country is as synonymous with the specifics of the black metal genre as Norway, and only a handful of bands can reasonably claim to be among the elite vanguard of black metal royalty like Emperor. In the Nightside Eclipse is a classic in the genre, and the creative leap between that full-length debut and its follow-up, Anthems to the Welkin at Dusk, was astounding. As Emperor grew into young adults and the scene's more shocking headlines began to fade, their music took on increasing bombast and atmosphere with an orchestral flair. Emperor left behind a catalog of four monstrous studio albums, each filled with its own secrets and nuances, dancing beneath the overarching symphony of aggro noise. Eitan released his seventh solo album this year, continuing to add important and diverse pieces to his life's work, working from the same town where he was born. In addition to his creative brilliance and aggressive innovation, this guy is a thoughtful and intelligent figure. Though his worldview evolves, his core contrarianism and his contempt for hypocrisy remains, with firm roots in the majesty of his country's past and the mythology of the genre he helped construct. On top of everything else, he's a fellow fan of one of my favorite bands of all time, Norwegian rock trio A-ha. So here it is, my conversation with Eitan. This is No Prize from God. Before we get into the life's bigger questions, I want to say before going head first into heavy metal and punk rock as a teenager, some of the first bands I loved were Adam and the Ants, Generation X, The Cure, but my absolute favorite band for years as a kid was A-ha. I saw an interview where you were talking about how they were like, what are you listening to? And you were like, well, it's not very metal. I'm listening to A-ha. And I'm like, that's one of my favorite bands of all time.
Yeah, it's an absolutely amazing band, and the songwriting, it's a wonderful band, and they have some extremely nice songs, really, just the craftsmanship. Even on the second Emperor album, it is not a rip-off, but it's like a small tribute to A-ha in there, where we actually used a small melodic part on top of some of the black metal riffs just to, yeah, I put that in there as a little tribute.
The minute we're finished talking, I'm going to dig that up and see if I can find it. That's amazing. Yeah, for me as a kid growing up in the 80s in Indiana, which, you know, in a nowhere part of a nowhere town, so to speak, you know, a-ha were one-hit wonders in America. So being like a huge fan of theirs was sort of strange and obscure, you know, after the song had worn off.
I'd assume it was just like Take On Me, and then
that was it. Yeah, and I remember, you know, trying to tell people like, no, there's The Sun Always Shines on TV, and there's Train of Thought. It looks just like the Take On Me video, but there's a pan flute, and I was following them. When Scoundrel Days, which is actually my favorite record, came out, enough that I was, you know, I was like 12 or 13 years old, but I was going to buy that on Street Date. And, you know, getting all the 12-inch singles with the extended mixes. And yeah, I was a hardcore fan.
I think in a way I think they maybe got as big as they could possibly get, you know, being a band from Norway. You know, and especially a pop band, and they, you know, of course, obviously before they broke in the UK, they had absolutely no support, you know, locally. To some extent, it's still like that in Norway, you know, that you know, we have some big shots these days, you know, with the producer team Stargate,
mm-hmm.
has been producing for, you know, Beyonce and whatnot, had like major hits. But it's like the boss of, you know, the commercial state channel, radio channel, mm-hmm. had some kind of beef with them personally. So he refused to play any of their hits.
Oh, wow.
You know, it's stuff like that. It's such a small scene.
Yeah.
So it evolves around Oslo and that pop scene. They live in a bubble in there. It's very unlike Sweden. Who have kind of with their kind of cultural background with ABBA and Roxette, Max Martin,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's they have a mentality that, yeah, Swedes are you know, we can make music, you know, in an international capacity, whereas in Norway it's the ideal is like this is almost on international quality, you know, for no reason. It's a strange thing. It's fascinating, but luckily I'm no part of that.
Yeah, it's interesting to think that it has to be almost validated somewhere else before people at home then kind of accept it. Yeah, I actually a few years ago, he may have more than one, but I have a record or two, I think, from Morten Harket solo records, and they're not in English. He's not singing in English.
No, but fun fact for you there. I mean, you know, or two, in fact. I mean, I've been able to meet a lot of, you know, my idols, you know, in the capacity of, you know, traveling and doing shows and festivals and all that. And obviously, one of my biggest heroes, of course, is Rob Halford.
Yes.
You know, so it's such a sweet guy. And, you know, we even in a professional way, you know, I mean, he called me, you know, unexpectedly sometime. And, you know, that's not the story, but I mean, he's a big influence, and of course he's the god of metal,
of course
regardless of how nice he is, you know, that aura is with him, so it's just that immense respect. But beyond that, I think one of the biggest stars I actually ever met, you know, like, you know, star wise was probably Morten Harket.
Wow, that's awesome.
I mean, and that we were part of the same, I mean, we were just there for a mutual friend, and because an author that me and my wife were collaborating with for some music, for some poetry and everything. He was the one, Håvard Rem, he's been writing a lot of the Morten Harket solo lyrics, you know,
wow.
And as a collaborator with him. So,
wow.
And he's a friend of mine, and his son was a student of mine. And yeah, Norway is a small place, but yeah, it was fun meeting Morten Harket.
Oh, that's incredible. Yeah. Yeah. And we appear to have much in common, because my profile picture on social media for the last, you know, year is a picture of me and Rob Halford.
Oh, perfect.
I've had the opportunity to interview him three different times over the last year. I do a I host a Q&A series at the Musicians Institute here in Los Angeles. And I've had Rob there twice where we do, you know, 90 minutes to an hour on stage. And it's basically just him and I in conversation. And then we take questions from the students. And yeah, he just couldn't be any more gracious. I mean, you know, there's some people that you meet, you know, 11 or 12 times and you're meeting them for the first time every time. And Rob's one of those guys where it's like instantly, you know, the second time I was ever around him, it's like we were old friends or something, you know, like.
That's my impression. I've just met him, you know, on a couple occasions, you know, usually not for very long, you know, but it's more like, you know, coming backstage, saying hi, you know, during a show or after a show or something, or, you know, the few emails and you know, talking on the phone, but it's yeah.
And I know he's
get what you mean.
yeah, and I know he's very welcoming in that way. And I know that he's a fan of yours, you know, like a legitimate fan. He's talked about your music and interviews and things like that, you know.
Yeah, I just saw that, you know, that he put up like anthems, member less one of his top ten.
Yes, I saw that. With Metallica.
And that's amazing.
And, you know, yeah,
that's why he, you know, called me once, because he, you know, he had uttered in some interviews that he actually wanted to do, you know, a joint album together with me, you know, so which was, of course, was a huge compliment.
Amazing.
And yeah, we discussed some of that, but of course he came back into Priest, and obviously his schedule, and you know, it amounted to nothing, but well. If you speak to him again, mention it and said
yes. I was just going to say
if he's still up for it, I'm still here. You know.
Yeah, I'm happy to pass that message along. Oh, fantastic. So digging into this a little bit. One thing that I'm not familiar with. What was your first introduction, as a child to these ideas of religion and faith and the bigger things and so on? Did you have anyone in your family who was religious, or was this introduced to you young, or no?
No, not really. It's just, you know, more like my none of my parents were any religious, and I wouldn't say, you know, my grandparents either. It was just, you know, like probably my grandmother, she had her kind of childhood faith, you know, so, something like that. Then they, you know, people got married in church and baptized and all that, but more like, you know, it's what everybody else did. Kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I had no religious background, and I remember I even got in a fight with not in a fight but like verbally with my first grade teacher, because she was super religious, and of course very imposing in that regard, and she started talking about, you know, the creation of the world, and I said no, sorry, you're wrong, that was the Big Bang. You know, and I got in trouble, and I guess it was, I don't think I gave it much thought, you know, before, you know, till I got a teenager, and probably also influenced by the type of music and the type of perspectives that you kind of start thinking about with, yeah, in that kind of rebellious state of mind.
Mm-hmm. And it's, did you find that was common sort of in the culture around you, that church and everything was sort of, you know, the community sort of cultural aspects of it, like you said, baptisms and weddings and so forth, but that the actual kind of core of the beliefs or the daily practices of it or whatever were absent?
It's just very fake,
you know? Yeah.
It had no substance to it. And I think I guess it's kind of strange almost to be, you know, this type of music. It's very associated with being a very opposition to, you know, Christian society and in Norway and, you know, everything that happened in the early 90s, all that. But I think maybe it's a consequence of whether consciously or subconsciously, you know, when you kind of are drawn to this type of music, these types of imagery, these types, you know, that kind of atmosphere and that thought pattern. Obviously, it's because on a search for something that's real.
Yes, you know? Yes.
And I think many of us who maybe felt a bit alienated from, you know, that typical pack mentality thing, you know, that's it, that feeling of everybody seeming to have, you know, so knowing what to do collectively, and you just felt a bit clueless. It was not like I was friendless or anything like that, or it was just an alienation, which I guess many people go through, whether they end up doing black metal or not. But I think you search for something that is real, and in that as a contrast, you see all the kind of hypocrisy of things around you, and how, you know, this religion, and it's always a bit more, it feels a bit more dangerous actually and threatening as an institution sometimes, because it's really not talked about, it's just there, and you just silently accept that, you know, you do all these rituals and you sing the songs and you kind of do the services when you're expected to. And, you know, really a very silent, invisible, you know, power in society, because kind of based on nothing, if that makes sense. So it's just like it's just like a kind of a silent acceptance of something where you see most people, they don't care. But if they are, you know, confronted by it, you know, they are very defensive about, you know, Norwegian Christian culture and all that. So that was probably, you know, the starting point of all this. And of course, it was just a natural kind of adversary, you mm-hmm. know. But when you start out and everything we grew up on, I mean, with Iron Maiden, you know, with Number of the Beast, and you know, that whole package of imagery and everything that came with it became, you know, that shell, that armor that showed yourself and everybody else that you stood apart from all that, you know. So it's rebellion at heart, but then I guess you get introduced to many of the more interesting aspects of that debate, you know, by being in that environment.
The art that I respond to is art that has a strong point of view, an authenticity to it, and it doesn't, by no means does it have to be my exact worldview or point of view or whatever, but just that, but it has something to say, and that could be personal, you know, provocative in some way. You know, a lot of times I say that and it's misinterpreted that I mean it has to be political or something.
I'm glad you say that, because it's, you know, when you say something like that, and you like you want the music to stand for something, you know, to have some substance, you know, that people behind it are kind of for real. It's and you can get provoked by it, or as you say, whether you agree or not. But yeah, people often want to make it into something political, and then it's kind of diminishing it, because in essence, and it's also very dangerous almost to talk about it in terms of art, because that's, you know, so that's very unpolitically correct, you know, to that's too big headed already. But it doesn't have to be. I mean, I think at least for myself, I mean, the reason for me being in music at heart, it's this kind of undescribable, you know, feeling, you know, it's not a happy feeling, it's not a sad feeling, it's just when you're dissolved in this moment of music or a piece of art or anything, just something that builds to that. And I think everybody who loves music in some way know what I'm talking about. And it's, I would assume that would be like a religious feeling.
Yes.
So I think, because as a music and other art forms as well, it's kind of that language. It can channel, you know, some of that existential fear, some of that those existential questions that we never get answered, you know, that we as humans kind of deal with. But of course, there are no answers to you know, concretely to all this. It cannot be simplified, you know, life and all this. But I think we can connect with it at that level.
Yes.
you know,
absolutely agree.
To kind of substitute that, but put out all the condemnation and all the rules of religion. So you kind of tap into a similar, that kind of metaphysical part of your mind, but without all the stigma.
Yeah, I feel like even in some, you know, some sort of pre-organized Christian tradition, when we're talking more, you know, tribal mystics who were out in the desert, you know, tripping out, that there there was something more like what you're describing at play than, you know, of course, what things eventually evolve into as they're codified and weaponized, as I like to say, into, you know, these tools of organizing society and so on.
Yeah, and you could say, I mean, this is it's probably going to sound harsh. I think I'm divided because as an individual and my respect for everybody else's individuality, you know, and that whole kind of philosophy of carving out your own moral grounds, you know, really feeling that inside yourself rather than just mimicking what people are telling you to be moral or moral standards, you know. I think that is so important. But then I look at the world around me and society more, how can I put it? I have great faith in people, you know, as individual people, you know, but I don't really have much faith in humans as groups always.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just that it... I dive in a bit too deep now. I kind of lost the train of thought. But
that's what we do here. We get in too deep.
Yeah, no, it's just, you know, too simplified, and it starts as soon as you have these big questions, as you said, and these big feelings that you can't really describe. Those big questions and of to put it bluntly, like the meaning of life or whatever you call it. And suddenly there's a rule book and there's all this stigma and it becomes political, you know, and it's given so much credit and people are groups of people, I would rather say, they're just destined to want to misinterpret. And I just caught on to what you were saying earlier with that, if you say anything about this, they will just narrow it down to something political,
right?
And that you're kind of discriminating someone, and people just, it seems like they're just looking for excuses to be offended, really.
of course. And one of the things that I was reading that I was struck by, you said it's very hard for you to pinpoint in particular what your belief system is because, you know, while there are some constants, there are also some things that change as well. You want to have a dynamic perspective on life and not settle for any given truth. And that all stems kind of from what drew you to being an outsider, and can barely describe how much I relate to that, you know, because even within different belief systems or different groups, I've always felt that outsiderness and a little, you know, I can't be boxed into specifically aligning with too much of anyone, you know. And what I've come to understand, for so much of my life, I looked at that as like a challenge or an obstacle to overcome, that I needed to eventually arrive at a more fixed point of certainty with my belief system. And what I've come to understand now as I've gotten older is that the beauty of all of it is actually in the mystery and is in the idea of the, for me anyway, you know, the idea of the
absolutely
questioning.
That's why I think that I found, so I mean, as I say, sometimes we read other stuff and read what other people say or have written, and that amazing feeling when you read a sentence from someone else, and you say, yes, in those, you know, two sentences, this person described all these things that I've actually had in the back of my mind. I just never put into words. Yes, this is it, which is basically how I feel most of the time reading Nietzsche. And you know, just to quote him on, you know, in relation to what you said, you know, that an absolute truth is more dangerous to truth than lies. You know, because they, yeah, they're just settling for, yes, I have the answer, you know, then in essence, that's just this totalitarian, you know, power thing. Because it's just like, yeah, I have the absolute truth, you know, and then everybody else is wrong. And that's the whole problem with, you know, the, all the different religions and everything that, you know, create all these wars and all this shit. Or if it's kind of fanatic political ideas or what have you.
Yes.
When people just settle for that absolute truth and just will deny anything else, because they can't be bothered to challenge their thinking and their perspectives. You know, it's they become very, very dangerous, I think. You know, there's nothing more dangerous than a man who thinks he has God on his side.
Yes. And I would argue, well, certainly it doesn't have the same historical or cultural sway by any means. I would by no means say that they're equivocal, but I do upset some people sometimes because I'm the guy that likes to point out that this sweeping new atheism, and I'm not talking about people who don't believe and that's their personal thing, but more this kind of movement that that religion is the sole, you know, most important overarching issue in humankind, and that destroying it is the most paramount of goals. And I would see that, you know.
I agree with you, because it's with some, you know, atheists, you know, or just, you know, people I've met who are people who love to have to confront Jehovah's Witnesses.
Right.
And like, you know, your friends said that, yeah, Jehovah's Witnesses came to my door and I really gave them, you know, a mouthful of what I felt about them. You know, it's, what's the bother? You know, I to be honest, I never felt, you know, hostility when, you know, they came knocking. It's like, sorry, I'm not interested.
Yeah.
You know, it's, these are, you know, obviously they're confused people, and it's not like, you know, I feel sorry for them, but there is absolutely no point in me, you know, trying to prove myself to these people. It's such a waste, you know.
Yeah.
It's a waste of my time. It's a waste of their time. But some people are more. What you're saying is probably that some people are more focused on telling everybody else what they're wrong about, you know, rather than actually having and it's substitute of thought matter themselves.
Yes, something that you stand for. And I realized, you know, earlier in my life, as certainly as a teenager, and as you said, you know, when you're getting into rebellious kind of counterculture music and art and films and things like that, I found that a big portion of my early life was defined by what I was against. And it's been more of a challenge as I've gotten older, to start trying to define myself also by what do I stand for? And which is a bit more difficult, because it's kind of easy to point to all the things that are terrible around us
it's very easy. And it's like with most people, you know, it's you have a lot of, resentment for politicians,
mm-hmm,
you know, of people who be like, yeah, the fucking politicians, there's, you know, wow, they're stupid and they should be thrown out of there. I mean, well, there's really no, if you, this is a horrible thing, but I thought it was a funny quote. Someone said like, yeah, my taxi driver was telling me everything that was wrong about politicians and the world. And it's just too bad he's too busy driving a cab instead of fixing it.
Right, you know? Right.
So, but it's very much like that.
Yeah.
And to me, I mean, I when you see, you know, politicians, the what they base their kind of decisions on, and it seems very strange from the outside. But in principle, these are people, for the most part, 95% of politicians are not necessarily power people. They're just people who really, you know, truly wants to make the world a better place, you know, and most of them work for free, you know, on evenings and parts and just try to and volunteer for stuff to to make a difference. And it's I'm sure it's much harder than just, you know, sitting on your ass in your couch and kind of criticize it.
And I do think that, you know, deconstructing is obviously important, and that's a big, you know, reason why we're talking.
Absolutely.
And I mean, you know, you named a record The Adversary, and much of your career has been defined by, you know, that being in opposition. But I think also, you know, I saw you, I think there was a Nietzsche quote actually that you used once about, you know, having to scream loud enough that the hard of hearing can hear you. I think I'm paraphrasing, but, you know, that this is an extreme art form, and that that's what it, this is the place to do that, you know?
Yeah, it's also, I mean, a lot of art is about creating a reaction.
It's
especially this form of, you know, it's not necessarily telling people what is the right thing. You know, you need to put up some perspectives and some juxtapositions, you know, in these questions, and not be, to be honest, I find a lot of metal these days, it's really very politically correct.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and people, which is understandable, because people are informed and people are, you know, I'm happy to say very, very, a lot of the metal people I meet are very easygoing and reflective people, you know, with not that many problems in their lives, you know, which is a good thing.
Yeah.
But at the same time, just as an example, I mean, in 2014, we did kind of some reunion shows with Emperor, you know, playing the entire In Lights of the Clips,
mm-hmm.
with our original drummer, you know, and you might know his story.
Yes, you know, I'm familiar. Yes,
but you know, people within the scene would be like, you know, how can you have this guy, horrible person, in your band, and you know, how could you let him into this, and yeah, be like really judgmental about, you know, us, you know, playing with him. And I was thinking, obviously, I can see from his point of view that, you know, his conviction, you know, what he had done and everything. Of course, you're entitled to have a personal opinion about whether, you know, he's served his sentences and all that. So kind of the Western legal system is kind of over it. You know, so it's that it's the kind of the common deal, you know, that you serve your time and then you kind of start over. So and of course everybody can have opinions about whether the punishment was enough or it was too little or too much, but at some point we just have to kind of leave it alone. But then on top of that, I was thinking, to be honest, if that level that the legal system sets, you know, for morals, if that's too weak for you in a way, and you need a higher level of political correctness, perhaps Norwegian black metal is not for you.
Yeah, perfect. I mean, and I, you know, I had, not to get too much on a tangent, but I had, as a journalist, I had written quite a bit about someone here in America who was in prison for 18 months. It's a long story, but he didn't murder someone, but he was present, and there was a lot of circumstances that put him in there, and he's had a troubled time since he's been out. And I'd written about him a lot in magazines, and actually working on a book with him. And it's heavy music, but it's very different than anything we're talking about. But my point in bringing that up is that I've had people, you know, say to me, how can you write about this person? How can you be friendly with this person? You know, he's done this and he's done that. And what I always say is, well, if Tommy Lee from Motley Crue walked in the room right now, would you take a selfie with him? And 9 times out of 10, that person goes, "Well, Tommy Lee, Motley Crue, of course, yeah."
Oh, it's so funny you say that, but because in those positions, not to interrupt you, but in those, you know, that kind of dilemma when you come for that, it's actually Motley Crue and some of these bands that have come to mind for me as well. Sorry,
please continue. Yeah, because then I immediately think, well, he was, you know, this artist that I'm talking about. There's been allegations of domestic abuse and issues like that, which of course are terrible if they're true. But then in the case of someone like Tommy Lee, he's confessed and been convicted and served time for it, you know, and then I was, you know, I follow Axl Rose on Twitter, and I've, you know, I saw the Guns N' Roses reunion at Coachella, and I went to see them on another date on that tour. And, you know, on Twitter, Axl Rose has been very, very critical, humorously, comedically so, about the Trump administration and the Trump family and so on. And at the same time, it's like, you know, this is a guy who, you know, had an N-bomb on a Guns N' Roses record, you know, and talked about immigrants and, you know, was alleged to have beaten Stephanie Seymour and locked her in a closet. And, you know, all these things that are so much worse than some of the standards that. So yeah, it's always interesting to me.
I think we've probably experienced a lot of the same thing, and this is the hypocrisy that we're always faced with when it's kind of. I mean, I always like to say there's a lot of things that I can't say I regret them, but you know that I've totally changed my mind about. You know, there were some extreme attitudes and positions I took early on. You know, in my teens, you know, probably the more, you know, opposition we got, probably the more extreme we wanted to, you know, the position we took.
Sure.
It was probably not very healthy at all. But at the same time, I'm very glad because when you put yourself at that edge of society, you get a very interesting perspective. You know, and also how opinions will change. You know, this is of course on a very mundane level. I see, you know, how people felt the first Emperor albums, how kind of morally depraved and horrible this music was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then when they sold enough, suddenly it was all okay, even though the contents did not change.
Now it's part of the Norwegian like tourism industry. It's in museums and
which I find entertaining. And you had also some years ago, some guy who 6 years prior to this had been involved in a Norwegian very, very underground black metal band. I just heard the name. I've never met any of them. And he was kicked out because he was doing drugs and all that, I think. And he got into martial arts and all kinds of bad, you know, company. And he was eventually was so fucked up that he broke into a funeral home and chopped off a dead man's head.
Wow.
You know, in a funeral home, which, you know, really bizarre. It's macabre.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but from what I learned, you know, this was a lonely man. You know, he had no one. You know, so when he was live, apparently no one cared about that old man. And the newspapers, they had black pages with white writing just to illustrate this is the worst thing that has happened in our city's history. You know? and then they called me because he was in a black metal band. It's like, I want my comment. And I said, I'm sorry, I don't know this person. I have no connection with this at all. And he's like, yeah, but he was in the black metal band. Well, I said, I'm sorry, but you can't call me for a comment every time someone who ever played a distorted guitar do something wrong. <You know?
laughs> Yeah.
Well, then you can comment. And like almost I needed to, so that I could go public and kind of wash my hands off this.
Yeah.
Because, and they almost fronted this as an opportunity for me to kind of distance myself from that, even though I had all the distance was there already, you know, to justify myself for playing black metal because they could relate something to it. You know, you see the stupid
Yeah,
position.
and if anything, distancing yourself from it would put you closer to it, because then it's like, why are you talking about it in the first place?
Exactly.
Yeah.
But in my head, I was thinking, in this city, you know, just knowing how some, I won't even, I dread even talking about, but how people, you know, are very wrong about kids and everything and kind of mix stuff up like that. Probably in your city, because it was not my city, it was, you know, a neighboring city. And it's like, there are probably worse thing than that macabre event happening every day
Yes,
in your
yes.
city. But it's just that this is something they could talk about. All this other shit, they don't, it doesn't stand the light of day, you know. And again, it's the hypocrisy that we all have to relate to. There are some very, very obvious, you know, what can I call them? Wrongdoings, and you know, some things are, you know, fully open for criticism. Other things are depending on which group of society you're part of. You can be criticized or you cannot be criticized. So there is no kind of common agreement I'm sorry. It's in English. I can we take it in Norwegian? No, it's
Well, I
no,
do, you know,
you get my point. You get my
I do listen to Morten Harkett solo albums. Maybe I can parse it
point. Yeah.
out. Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. And you know, it's getting back to your earlier point, kind of where we started on this too. What happened to danger and recklessness and unpredictability? You know, it's like we want to have our cake and eat it too, as they say, where we want the dangerous and provocative art, and yet we expect the artists who create it to constantly be held to standards that most people can't even really hold themselves to. You know, I mean, imagine if everyone had to be accountable for things that they said and did when they were teenagers as
Oh
in their adult life, you know?
that's what I say. Good luck. Imagine having what you said, you know,
Yeah.
the internet when you were 16, you know, for the rest of your life. You'll be my guest.
So many times I've been thankful that you know, YouTube and social media and all that didn't exist when I was a teenager. You know,
Oh, me too.
my thoughts are lost in you know, fanzines that there were 50 copies of.
Yeah,
You
yeah.
know, it disappeared.
Thomas, you know, or Samuel Tenebre, you know, he it's not that long ago, he said to me, "Oh man, I'm so glad we didn't have Facebook. You know, imagine the stuff we'd have put out there, you know."
Absolutely. Something I have always been curious about, taking a little bit of turn, but staying in the same subject matter generally. And of course, you know, I understand that there's limitations on what you can and can't discuss in terms of specifics, but you know, as an outsider, as somebody who was aware of the black metal scene as it was emerging, but of course, you know, from across an ocean and pre-internet days where, you know, I knew people that were writing letters back and forth with people in Norway and that sort of thing, but that was about as deep as it got. I'm curious, you know, in terms of this spirituality and life's bigger questions and all of that, of course, when we think about the extracurricular activities, the
Yeah.
things outside of the music that were happening. You know, it's easy to understand the spirit of rebellion and that sort of thing. Was there ever, and I realize this would be different for each individual, so in your personal experience, was there ever a spiritual component to that? Because I feel like sometimes that's ascribed to it, but I don't, I feel like it's really only for you to say, not for someone
Yeah,
else to say, you know?
I think a lot of that stuff that happened, you know, and that holds in those years, obviously, as I'm sure there is in so many situations, you know, with an underground thing, it's given so much substance kind of after the fact, you know,
Yes.
that it was much, you know, much more profound and thought through. Whereas, in essence, you know, I guess, yeah, at the time, you know, probably 80% of the people involved in that scene and being on that kind of mass, you know, or in a very small scale, but mass seduction of all these things that we got into.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're teenagers, you know, and with a very, very strong, you know, I guess, you know, from when it first started out, and the more opposition, you know, the more empowered I think everybody felt, you know, for having the impact, you know, by not, you know, because obviously when you take, you know, with the imagery, the clothes and the music and everything, it's very typical that it's ridiculed, mm-hmm. you know, and taken, you know, just whiffed away. And I think everybody felt very, very empowered, you know, when he had an image of being dangerous, and suddenly people felt, fuck, this is dangerous, you know?
Yeah, like a life imitating art imitating life, and where does one begin and end at that point? Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and at that point, you know, teenagers, you know, like you feel, you know, overpowered by all that kind of, all the collectiveness of people, and suddenly, you know, they don't... they're not able to kind of disregard it, you know. I think it again, as I said, it's probably very individual from everyone you speak to, and I'm sure even Samoth would have a very different perspective than I. To be honest, he was very much more not in thought and involvement, you know, musically or anything like that, but he was really the one with the contacts. So even within that black scene, I guess, well, I was a bit of a loner, you know, a kind of outsider even in that.
Yeah.
So I never really connected, you know, with that group of people. He had kind of the network and was much more involved like that.
Outcast among the outcast. I love it.
Yeah, it's not like, you know, kept outside kind of thing. It's just that, it's nothing heartbreaking about it. If you get what I mean.
No, absolutely.
It was just a situation. It was never really, you know, a goal for me either. You know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wonder, you know, because it's easy to romanticize, and I think as you describe the sort of life imitating art and the circle of it, you know, it's like you think of Bruce Wayne putting on the Batman costume for the first time, and he's very aware that he's a guy dressing up as a bat, but then as soon as people are responding to him as Batman, then it's like he becomes Batman, you know, and I would imagine there was something like that, you know.
You know, I'm not a big comic fan or anything like that, but if I had to choose one, obviously Batman would be my favorite superhero.
Yes.
He has a lot of cool artifacts. You know, it's dark.
Mm-hmm.
That, of course, that helps. But mainly because I think as a symbol, you know, relating to what we do.
Yes.
It's like he's not a superhero because he got some kind of power, or, you know, he became a superhero because he decided to.
Yeah,
you know, and that's a very Nietzschean kind of.
Yeah, and a very black metal, you know, in that sense of creating imagery, both in your personal appearance and then in the art and the music that you create that is communicating these bigger ideas that that you want to put across, a symbol. Yeah, I love it. I'm curious now. You know, you've mentioned Nietzsche, obviously, and I think, and without belaboring the point, for people who are far outside of not only the black metal scene, but extreme metal or extreme art of any kind, you know, it's very easy to think like, oh, devil worshippers and Satan and so on. And obviously, just, you know, a perfect segue from what we were just talking about was symbols. I think many people misunderstand that even for someone like King Diamond, you know, when he's talking about Lucifer or whatever, it's more the symbol of rebellion or of, you know, an agent of change or that.
Yeah, a rebeller, You know, it's a very natural kind of nemesis to that it was that it which everybody else accepts. You know, the one that challenges that kind of common perception of things. So I think it's obviously rock and roll music has always kind of taken on that position. You know, either by being lost, you know, lost from God or cast out, and
yes.
You know, it kind of goes through everything, and I think if you look at with the satanic imagery and all that, I think especially from a Christian perspective, okay, so they do not worship God, hence they will worship the devil,
right?
You know, and but the opposite of worshiping, that's the kind of the clue thing that you don't really worship, you question. You know, it's worshiping any god, you know, whether good or bad one. That's I think the whole worship idea, you know, just again, you know, just randomly picking one absolute truth and just never question it. That is worship, you know. And I think in essence, the, you know, the satanic imagery thing, it appeals. It's the opposite of that.
Well, and picking one. You know, ironically, and I'm very inspired by a couple different theologians who, you know, emerged from the Christian perspective and are wrestling with this and exploring it, that I'm really fascinated by the idea that God himself has become an idol, you know, within these monotheistic traditions that reject idol worship. That this whole monolithic religion in and of itself has become an idol that's being a false idol, you know, and there's a way of I may not be articulating it nearly as well as these guys with, you know, multiple PhDs and things, but in essence, this idea that to really serve God, you have to destroy God. And it's, it's fascinating. And to your point about rock and roll, you know, there's a great quote, and this was one of the things that inspired this podcast, actually, when I read this from Bono, of all people, a number of years ago. There's a quote where he said, "The music that really turns me on is either running toward God or running away from God. Both recognize the pivot that God is at the center of the jaunt." And I think you can take that God and say good and evil or big life's big questions or you know, if you want to. But I like you said, it was one of those moments where you read a quote and you go like, oh, he's just said that for me. Where I realized, yes, that's the art and the music that I've always been the most turned on by is.
And I always get the question of, you know, why are you always making, you know, this dark music? You know, and I said that in some kind of press release that went out, as I always intend to make the darkest possible album, you know, and I guess, just because it's so natural for me to kind of think in those metaphors, but I think it just struck me that what I probably should say to people who are, you know, when I say I want to make a dark record to someone who love this type of music, they will get it. But for someone else, you know, who are estranged by this, I would always try to make a very profound record, you know, that deals with, you know, serious stuff, you know,
yes.
Like, you know, existential crisis, you know, it's that kind of chaos, that kind of rapture that as humans find us in. We cannot just flow on the surface all the time. You know, we need to allow ourselves to know these depths and get to know ourselves, you know, fully with faults and potential, you know, that encompasses all we are, and you can't necessarily know yourself by just, you know, ignoring that side of you, you know, ignoring your dark sides or you, these big questions, and just go happy go lucky all the time. And even, you know, I would consider myself rather happy and very, very lucky person. I'm where I'm at in my life. I'm super happy, honestly. But that doesn't stop me from kind of exploring these subjects. you know, musically and lyrically, and because I can't really say why, you know, but I'm drawn to this, and this is my world. This is what I know, and this is kind of the artistic world that I and that space that I work best within, you know. So, and you know, it's why do you like sweet instead of sour? You know, it's you can't really say, but I was just you know, this is a digression from what I was talking about just now. But when you mentioned earlier that you could always refer to someone else who just said it better. Often when I'm confronted, like, okay, so what is your stand on things? You know, and I would say, boringly enough, I would say probably some middle ground, you know, influenced by, you know, where it's drawn into politics and all that. I'd say like a mix between Sam Harris and Nietzsche, you know, but probably more, you know, in a modern sense, you know, a bit more like, you know, when I watch Sam Harris stuff, you know, like, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I am very familiar, and he's also a wish list guest for this podcast.
Yeah, he's so calm, he's so understanding. It's just very, very intellectual. It's not disrespectful, and I just, you know, I saw that episode when he was attacked by Ben Affleck.
Yes, you know, on the Bill Maher show. Yeah,
spent like 12 minutes just bombarding him and just really proving the point he made, you know, in the first 5 seconds.
Yeah, and I think Ben Affleck was hopped up on those Batman steroids at the time, so he was a bit aggressive. That's so funny the way you put that. Yeah, I would my worldview I would describe as somewhere between Peter Rollins, who is one of these philosophers I was referencing, and Morrissey. Although, back to your way earlier point about constantly evolving, you know, Morrissey said a few dodgy things lately, so I'm gonna have to pick somebody else.
Someone actually told me that, because I referenced Nietzsche, you know, and in my youth, when I started reading Zarathustra, you know, at the same time, someone was telling me, like, yeah, he was like, you know, his philosophy was kind of more or less feeding the Nazi philosophy. I was like, what the fuck? I don't want to read this, and I kind of just disregarded it. But you know, coming back to it later, you know, it was his sister, you know, after he died, that presented all this stuff, and they kind of totally misused it, as much of intellectual work often is, you know, for their own political means. But I mean, anyone who can read any Nietzsche, I think, would quickly see that he was totally against any form of marching. I mean, in general, he had almost had a resentment for the German population. You know, so it's and just as misunderstood as, you know, I would say that how, when I mentioned Nietzsche, I think people react to that in a similar way that Ben Affleck reacts to Sam Harris. You know, he says one thing and he just consequently just, yeah, and I misunderstand you and you're an idiot. You know, it's like, oh. So it's frustrating, but
this kind of brings us full circle too, because you know, even as I hear myself saying how much I identify with so many things Morrissey has said over the years, and then there are things that he said that I absolutely would reject. That's one of the dangers of religion, is picking something and saying, yes, I am that, I believe in that 100%. No, I mean, with just about everything, there's going to be, there should be caveats where you go, well, I like this, but with the exception of maybe this part, you know, I mean, I loved reading H.P. Lovecraft as a kid, and you know, I didn't know until an adult that he was apparently like a horrible racist. You know, and it's like okay, but so should I throw all of H.P. Lovecraft's work in the dumpster? You know, it would be just as foolish as a black metal fan saying that they won't listen to your solo records or go see Emperor because of something that the original drummer was arrested for, and then you know, it's the same type of mentality. Or that,
does it matter? I mean, it's like, do you know the Norwegian writer Knut Hamsun?
I don't.
No, he's won, you know, I think he got that you know, Nobel Literature Prize. You know, he's dead, you know, long ago, but he's one of the absolute biggest, you know, authors in Norway, from Norway. You know, his writings is, you know, above, you know, most of everything else from his time. He's like a true icon. Mm-hmm. But during the war, he had kind of brown sympathies, and then with, you know, and it's of course now many years is fully open about that, but people seem they can't really they will some people will disregard his entire writing because of that, that he in his you know, very old years, you know, fucked up like that. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a, so and they cannot, I mean,
it's like disregarding everything that LaVey had to say because of some of the corny magic rituals, or because some of the stupid things people were into, or disregarding everything that Jesus Christ stood for, if you believe he was a historical real figure that said and did these certain things because of all the horrible things that have been done in his name. You know, yeah. I think that that idea of throwing the baby out with the bathwater and most absolutely. Things is foolish, you know.
I just remember, I mean, I was discussing this with a deeply Christian friend of mine, and we've been discussing it. Of course, I was quoting Nietzsche, you know, hard. and so just to pick up on a conversation when I met him again, like, okay, so, but you know, you follow Nietzsche. And I said, no, that's the whole point. I don't follow, you know, I find things when I read stuff that he put into words, you know, such an immensely intelligent person. It doesn't mean that I follow and I take for granted, well, Nietzsche said it, so it has to be true. That's the whole point. And that's probably would be his entire point as well. You know, in his Zarathustra, he says, like, and it's very biblically written, that and it's like Zarathustra says to his disciples, you know, that it's very much like that. And like, only when you have denied me, I will come back to you. Because his whole point was, you know, what's the purpose of being a teacher if your students always remain students? Mm. You know?
Yes. Yes, yes, yes. Perfect. Well, I will say, to bring us completely from the start to the finish of our conversation, if you have the occasion to meet Morten Harkett again, and he asks you about the music that you make, you can tell him what you so wonderfully articulated to me about making something that is profound and that has meaning and that is above the noise with substance and something to say.
At least an attempt.
Well, I would say, and I could speak from many of your fans, that you've certainly succeeded in that, and the body of work that you've created has done that many times. It's
very kind of you to say.
Well, excellent. Well, I'm so happy that you were able to make the time to do this, and it couldn't have gone better. It's everything I would have hoped.
My pleasure. It was a very interesting conversation, and a kind of a break for me just talking about you know, all my wonderful ideas about the new album.
yeah. I figure it was better than Who Are Your Influences and Tell Me About the Album Title and yeah, nice breath of fresh air. Okay. Yeah.
I'm very privileged that actually people give a shit, you know.
Of course, and that's a great way to look at it. Well, excellent, yeah. And I would love to stay in touch and have you on again at some point down the road.
I'd love to.
You would be a great repeat guest. So.
Oh, thank you. I'm sure we have more to talk about.
Indeed.
If we get the chance.
Indeed. Awesome. Be sure to check out Ishan.com to stay up to date on all of the accomplished singer, guitarist, composer, multi-instrumentalist, and cultural innovator's creative output. You can find No Prize From God on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, as well as on Patheos, where our blog takes a deep dive into the subject we've explored with our guests. You can find me on Twitter at Ryan Downey and on Instagram at SuperheroHQ. And you can check out past episodes of No Prize From God with great guests like Maddie Mullins of Memphis Mayfire, Jesse Leach of Killswitch Engage, Karen Crisis of Gospel of the Witches,
Tim from Under Oath, Ryan Clark of Demon Hunter, Satyr of another important Norwegian black metal band, Satyricon, Sister Kate of the Sisters of the Valley, aka the Weed Nuns, Dwid Hellion from Integrity, Max Cavalera of Soulfly, Modern Tarot author Michelle T., and more. And please head into iTunes or wherever you consume podcasts and leave us a 5-star rating and a nice little review. The more of those we receive, the higher the visibility for the podcast and the more it can be discovered. No Prize from God is part of the Pop Curse Podcast Network. If you're a Metallica fan, check out our sister podcast, Speak and Destroy, a podcast about all things Metallica. Guests have included members of Megadeth, Pantera, Machine Head, Lamb of God, and Hailstorm, as well as the aforementioned Rob Halford of Judas Priest. As always, you guys have been great, and I've been Ryan J. Downey.